Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
All right, I am back, doing some Q&A questions. I know, I'm never ever going to catch up, but what are you gonna do? Now, in some ways there are some benefits to waiting so long before answering some of these questions. For one thing, I can chew the cud, so to speak, and think things over in my head. All the while I'm, you know, doing other episodes, and I can think about it, get some context, do some reading. Let's get into the one question for today. So Van asks, Sus Indiana? Sus Indiana indeed. Longtime listeners of Program to Chill will know my fixation with Sus Indiana. I think it started off as purely schizo pattern recognition, but upon researching it further, I think there is actually something here, to the point where Hoosiers play an outsized role in a lot of business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica. Let's break it down. So Indiana literally means land of the Indians, or Indian land. And it was named that because it was literally Indian territory at the start of the 19th century. So yes, all of America is theft of Indian land, but Indiana was like, very literally like, designated for Indians, even by the colonizers' government, before it was stolen by force, right? Now, it's not clear where the term Hoosier came from, but current scholarship believes that it may have been a term for a country bumpkin or a rough countryman, and that the term was used in the Virginias and the Carolinas. And, you know, people from those states are largely who ended up settling Indiana, right? Now, stealing the land and filling it with rough country bumpkins could be the original sin of Indiana, I imagine, starting off on the wrong foot, so to speak. But as we will see, the crimes just kept accumulating and mounting when it comes to Indiana state history. Indiana has been described as the most southern of the northern states. At least that's what they were saying back during the Civil War. So, right off the bat, one of the key things for understanding Indiana would be the Indianapolis treason trials of 1864. Essentially, during the Civil War, Union military officials saw evidence of multiple secret organizations conspiring to commit treason. I mean, this makes sense, right? There was a Civil War on. But in particular, we're talking about the Knights of the Golden Circle and related groups, like the Order of American Knights and the Sons of Liberty. These groups were large, organized, and working directly with Confederate military leaders. Side note here, the Knights of the Golden Circle had a Committee of Public Safety, like the French Revolution, which is very ironic, I think. So the Knights of the Golden Circle appear to have had 3 degrees, like in Freemasonry. The first degree was the Knights of the Iron Hand, which in 1859 was estimated to number around 7,000 men. The second degree, the Knights of the True Faith, was the commercial and financial division. At the top of the pyramid was the third and governing degree, known as the Knights of the Columbian Star. The first oath for the first degree was as follows. Do you, calling each candidate by name, solemnly swear before God and these witnesses that you will keep sacred the signs, passwords, and significations of the 28, which is to say the Knights of the Iron Hand, from all persons save members of the 28? Except compelled to divulge the same in due course of law in any court of the United States, where you shall be required to testify to the same, that you will be true to your allegiance to the 28, that you will defend them against all their enemies on land or at sea. Do you swear to obey their laws, rules, and regulations, and to execute, if on your power, every lawful commission entrusted you, that you will do all you can as an honorable man to promote the best interests of the 28, and that you will deal justly by every brother 28 as if he were your natural brother, so help you God. To this, every candidate answers yes and kisses the Bible. Now, the second degree was only given to those in, like, commercial and financial positions, so it had less ceremony. The third degree was never written down, and it was much more controversial, but it was eventually leaked to a journalist in Louisville in 1861. Mind you, what I'm about to quote and the oath I read earlier both come from a book, Knights of the Golden Circle by David Keene. And so here is the third degree's ritual as reported by that journalist. In the ritual, the inductee swears an oath of absolute secrecy and promises to report to the Knights of the Golden Circle leaders on abolitionists, Roman Catholic ministers, and Northern teachers, and to do all in his power to put down insurrections that those suspect individuals might foster. The ritual then proceeds to an unabashed declaration that when the Knights of the Golden Circle intervenes in Mexico, it will sustain an effort to reduce the 88 to 89. 88 referring here to the peon system, 89 referring to the system of perpetual slavery. The ritual then requires them to divide the newly created slaves proportionately among the members of the Knights of the Golden Circle's three degrees. Third degree members are given a preference for high office in establishing the government in Mexico. The ritual provides that a limited monarchy should be recognized as the best form of government until the civil, financial, and religious reconstruction of Mexico has been completed. With the eventual annexation of Mexico to the United States as a slave state. Now, I gotta wonder the question, like, who the hell would they place as king? I wonder. Either way, taking over Mexico is something of a pipe dream, given how the Alamo went, but either way, there were Knights of the Golden Circle cells across Ohio, Illinois, Iowa, and Indiana, as well as many other places. And in fact, in the case of the city of Baltimore, both the mayor and the chief of police were Confederate sympathizers, and they conspired to dynamite railroad bridges leading into the north. Like, we are talking about a serious major fifth column in the United States, organized largely through these secret societies. They were oriented around the Democratic Party, particularly the Copperhead faction, which is to say those Democrats who opposed the Civil War and wanted to broker a peace settlement with the Confederacy. Union investigators started investigating in 1861 and 1862. In 1862, a federal grand jury in Indiana arrested some 60 Knights of the Golden Circle members for resisting taxation and preventing enlistments in the Union Army. In 1863, Union military in Indiana set up espionage operations to monitor these groups. To their chagrin, they found that civil trials were not effective in convicting these offenders. Further, the Union's civil and military authorities worried that prosecuting these guys could very well spark mass uprisings. Initially, President Lincoln didn't think the threat was that great, but he eventually changed as things got harder and harder during the Civil War. Additionally, the U.S. presidential election of 1864 figured prominently into this equation. Therefore, the Union military ordered the leaders of these groups to be arrested. Like, we're talking about the U.S. military arresting civilians for crimes. And again, we're talking about this largely occurring in Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, and Kentucky. Now, the governor of Indiana was pushing for them to carry out this plan, and the military district of Indiana ended up carrying out the trials, which is why it became known as the Indianapolis Treason Trials. They held the trials in Indianapolis. So in September 1864, they arrested the Grand Commander of the Sons of Liberty, the prominent Indianapolis businessman known as Harrison H. Dodd. In the raid against him, they found 400 revolvers and thousands of rounds of ammo. Dodd was charged with disloyalty and conspiracy. On September 27th, 1864, they held the trial, which was open to the public. In the trial, they had the U.S. Army spy Felix Steiger, who had infiltrated the Sons of Liberty. Steiger would become the secretary of the Kentucky branch of the Sons of Liberty. Steiger testified that they had plans involving assassinations, freeing Confederate prisoners, armed uprisings, and plans to work directly with the Confederate Army. In October 1864, they arrested other leaders of the Sons of Liberty. Most of these men were also affiliated with the Democratic Party, like pretty high up in various state party machines. On October 7th, 1864, Dodd escaped from his prison cell and fled to Canada. He was sentenced to death in absentia. When they held the trial, the defense focused on the possibility that U.S. Army spies had acted as agents provocateurs. The defense did not work, however, and the defendants were all found guilty and sentenced to death. The verdicts were kept secret until Lincoln could personally approve them, and he gave the go-ahead in January 1865. In December 1866, the U.S. Supreme Court argued that civilians cannot be tried in military tribunals in times and places where civil courts are still active, which was the case in this situation. Now, that was actually a major civil liberties ruling, which is still in force today. I actually, in researching this episode, I found a current Supreme Court judge discussing this particular case in broader context, which was funny. Anyway, the point is that Indiana was full of Knights of the Golden Circle cells, which was a secret society explicitly oriented around undermining the Union and creating a slave-owning society throughout North America, and like literally taking over Mexico, which I think lays a good groundwork for like, why is Indiana like this? Alright, so if we're talking sus Indiana in mostly chronological order, we should talk about the Ishmaels, or as they're also known, the Tribe of Ishmaels, because it introduces several topics that are going to come up again and again with regards to Indiana. So the Ishmaels were a group of poor whites from Pennsylvania. They seem like a very interesting group for what it's worth. They would be frequently compared to like gypsies, and they did have some really unique customs. However, the Ishmaels were studied under the idea that poverty is hereditary and not environmental. And wouldn't you know it, there was a particular minister who spearheaded the study of this group. He was a minister for the Plymouth Church, Plymouth Brethren, which, lol, where have I heard of that sect before, right? And this minister found, turns out, the data is in. Poverty is hereditary, folks, so pack it in. We don't need to do welfare. We don't need to do outreach. We gotta do eugenics. So the minister, who was also the president of the Indianapolis Benevolent Society, he published his findings in a book entitled The Tribe of Ishmael, A Study in Social Degradation. He compared the Ishmaels to parasites, like literal parasites, and he said, "These human parasites were draining the city of Indianapolis of its resources and exacerbating their own problems by receiving charity." This minister recommended that Indianapolis stop relief and charity work, sterilize the Ishmaels, and take away their children. So the Ishmaels became quasi-famous along with several other related families. There were a lot of scientific papers arguing that these families were all huge pieces of shit, basically. They were made the very literal, like, face of the undeserving poor, to use their term. They became case studies which paved the way for what is known as the Indiana Plan, which, more on that in a minute. In the 1970s, the tribe of Ishmael was rediscovered by yet another minister, this time Unitarian, a guy named Hugo Prosper Learning. He published an essay about the Ishmaels entitled "The Ben Ishmael Tribe, a Fugitive Nation of the Old Northwest." He argued that the tribe of Ishmael was actually Muslim, and that they included a significant number of black people, which does not seem to be historically accurate, by the way. To be sure, there is an interesting legacy of interracial communities which are usually extremely marginalized in complicated ways, but on the flip side, this guy and several others tended to play extremely fast and loose with studying these interracial communities. This minister, you know, Hugo Prosper Learning, he argued that the Ishmael tribe formed a proto-black nationalism. He argued that they even went on Hajj, that they practiced polygamy, that the Nation of Islam was inspired by them. By the way, virtually none of this appears to be true. As it turns out, this minister was basically just making shit up. This Unitarian minister would end up changing his name to Hugo Prosper Learning Bey. Yes, explicitly like Hakim Bey, who would also talk a lot about the Ishmaelites. So Hugo Prosper Learning would convert to Islam. So there is definitely a weird projection thing going on here. Somehow the Ishmaels were just like a magnet for the most insane clergy to just gravitate and mess with them. Anyway, this is Programmed to Chill, so I always have to bring everything back to materialism, to things grounded in reality, right? My contention is that the Ishmaelites were targeted precisely because they abstained from the wage labor economy. That's the one thing you cannot do, and that is why they received so much attention. So the Ishmaelites became the prime example that eugenicists would show the public in order to pass the Indiana Plan. The Indiana Plan was the most aggressive eugenics program in the country, and I believe also in the world. Although sterilization laws were supposed to be about sterilizing those with mental disabilities, morons, and so forth, if we're talking sheer numbers, they were frequently sterilizing poor whites from Kentucky and Tennessee more than anything else. From 1907 to 1974, Indiana would formally sterilize around 2,500 people. That's roughly 37 a year. Now, that doesn't sound like a ton, but keep in mind that there were probably unrecorded sterilizations, and also that's like a huge number over a period of time, right? And if you really think about what it means to sterilize someone without their knowledge or consent, like, talk about changing someone's life, right? Also, I must say, there were sterilizations, hundreds, before 1907, which were not as assiduously recorded. So, I mean, the numbers go up. Interestingly, the guy who invented vasectomies, named Dr. Harry C. Sharp, which, lol, what a name for inventing vasectomies. He innovated vasectomies during his work at the Indiana State Prison. He specifically directed vasectomies against sexual delinquents. And to be clear, he considered masturbation to be sexual delinquency, so keep that in mind. Sharp was involved in the push to adopt the Indiana Plan. Also pushing it was Governor James Frank Hanley, governor of Indiana, who was also a hardline prohibitionist. Hanley was also known for his efforts at enforcing racial purity, which we will return to in a minute. Another big proponent of eugenics was David Jordan, the president of the University of Indiana. He told his students that paupers were parasites. Paupers meaning poor people, right? Now, David Jordan wrote a book entitled Blood of a Nation, which argued that blood proved race. Jordan would then become the first president of Stanford. It's not much, but I did see some articles with Stanford students rejecting the legacy of David Jordan, trying to get his name off of buildings, which, you know, say what you will, but I don't think that's a bad thing. Now, most of the sterilizations in the Indiana Plan would take place at the Fort Wayne State School for Feeble-Minded Youth, as well as the state prison. And there was a huge jump in sterilizations which occurred around the 1940s, which I found to be interesting. I'm not exactly sure what it means.
Yeah.
right, back to Indiana indeed, and in some ways, coming full circle from some of my very first episodes. Because what I know about Indiana is that the Sullivan family of Sullivan and Cromwell were old Indiana lawyers. We're talking John Foster Dulles and Allen Dulles's grandfather, Foster Dulles. He grew up in Indiana, he was an Indiana lawyer, and he was that before he achieved national prominence. If you'll recall, he was in like presidential cabinets and so forth. So we know that Indiana led the country in eugenics. Let's see what else they led the nation in. Let's see here. Indiana led the country in, I see right here in my notes, the Klan, fascism, and the development of Christian identity theology. So the Klan was very big in Indiana after its revival in the 1920s. Yes, I think the revival of the Klan, the second wave as it were, technically started at Stone Mountain, Georgia, but I'll be damned if it didn't just spread like wildfire in Indiana specifically. There would also be a large number of race riots in Indiana related to the Klan's presence. There was a minister named Gerald Smith who started his ministry in Wisconsin, but for most of the 1920s he was in Indianapolis. While he was in Indiana, his ministry worked directly with the Klan. Eventually, Gerald Smith moved his ministry to Louisiana, where he aligned his church with Huey Long, the Kingfisher. Gerald Smith got support from Utica Mutual Life, an insurance company. And to be more clear, an insurance company was backing and supporting him. And so Gerald Smith would move to Michigan, where he started getting funding from the Dodge and Olds brothers in order to have Gerald Smith appear on the radio and broadcast and just like rail against the New Deal. Gerald Smith also had a personal friendship with Henry Ford. I'm telling you, man, auto manufacturers, they are, for some reason, just all about promoting this insane version of Christianity. Like I said, I'm sure that most of it is because of the anti-union stuff, and because they're essentially Nazis. Or, as, you know, that one episode I did a while back said, they pretty much have the same social views as Nazis, right? I mean, at the end of the day, Nazis and the Klan are not terribly far off, right? Oh, also, goes without saying, but Gerald Smith was also explicitly pro-Nazi too, right? And somewhere in this story, he actually joined the Silver Shirts, which, before World War II, largely, it was a... or it could have been a American Nazi sort of fascist party. It was run by a guy named William Dudley Pelley, which, by the way, William Dudley Pelley, leader of the Silver Shirts, would-be fascist leader of America, known early UFO enthusiast, he actually relocated his group to Indiana, like I'm pretty sure after World War II. I think he started in Asheville, but he ended up in Indiana. William Branham, the Christian identity cult preacher who I am currently super obsessed with, he had his congregation in Indiana. Robert Welch, the candy maker, the candy manufacturer, had a small factory in Indiana. And Robert Welch founded the John Birch Society. He did that in Indianapolis. Now, what is it about Indiana that makes it such fertile ground for basically fascist politics? I mean, we've already said so far that it was land populated by rough country bumpkins who explicitly stole the land from Native Americans, and then there's a whole lot of eugenics going on. And at this point, it's almost like got its own gravitational power in terms of like, why the fuck are all the fascists in Indiana? Now, switching gears here, the Federal Correctional Complex at Terre Haute, Indiana was built in 1940. It includes the U.S. Penitentiary, Terre Haute, which is where federal prisoners on death row are housed. Timothy McVeigh was there, Dylan Roof is there now. They have a lot of high-profile prisoners, right? Then, there's the Federal Correctional Institution, Terre Haute, which has the interesting CMU, or Communication Management Unit. That's where they house Muslims mostly, because they're afraid of an Islamization and radicalization of the prison population. In the 1940s, the broader prison complex carried out the infamous Terre Haute prison experiments, which studied sexually transmitted diseases. These experiments included injecting prisoners with gonorrhea. Many of the same people that did these experiments would carry out the also infamous Guatemala syphilis experiments, which were as fucked up as they sound. Switching gears yet again, Charles Manson's fate was maybe sealed in Indiana, actually. The story is horrible, and in this period of Manson's life, you really feel sorry for him. Due to his family's instability, Manson was sent to the Gibault Home for Boys in 1947, which is there at Terre Haute. He was sent there when he was 12. He escaped the school and became a runaway. Now, the first known crime that he committed was in Indianapolis, where he robbed a grocery store in 1948. It's actually a really depressing story because the robbery was initially about him just straight obtaining food, like he was starving. But then he found cash and took that also. And apparently, Charles Manson, this is like at the age of 13 or 14, he rented a room in Indianapolis' Skid Row and he just like ate as much food as he could. Super sad stuff, man. Then Charlie Manson worked briefly as a Western Union message deliverer. But Charlie Manson kept stealing. Eventually the police discovered that he was a runaway. And that's how Charlie Manson ended up at the Indiana Boys School near Plainfield. Side note, Charlie Manson working as a Western Union message deliverer reminds me both of the fact that William Stevenson also was a telegram delivery boy, and some of the stuff I talked about with Philip Fairbanks about some of those, like the British royal family involved in a, like a call boy ring. The boys were, their cover story was that they were like mail and telegraph delivery boys. I don't know if there's something to it, but like, damn if it doesn't make me wonder, you know? So anyway, Charlie Manson, Indiana Boys School. I have a quote here about his time at that school. During this time, he was frequently detained at the Indiana Boys School near Plainfield. It's been speculated that it was at the Indiana School for Boys that 5-foot-tall Charles Manson was beaten and raped repeatedly over 3 years. During one of these detentions, young Manson was, quote-unquote, discovered by a local priest, Reverend George Powers. This particular boy seemed very lonesome, just craving attention and affection, recalled Father Powers, now an instructor at the New York Theological Seminary. He looked like an innocent altar boy, and he was so ashamed of his mother, unquote. Now, so, like, you see what's going on here, right? Like, Charles Manson got sexually abused in one of these, you know, boys' juvenile facilities, and then he gets discovered by a local priest. Okay. I continue with the article. Father Powers arranged for Manson to be sent to the famous Father Flanagan's Boys Town near Omaha, Nebraska. The Indianapolis News ran a front-page story in March 7, 1949, headlined, "Dream Comes True for Lad, He's Going to Boys Town." It characterized 14-year-old Manson as a dead-end kid who was getting a second chance by being sent to the last chance haven for wayward boys. "He won everybody over," the priest said. The juvenile court judge was completely taken with his personality. He had ability beyond his years to present himself. He was a beautiful kid for his age. Young Charlie, however, did not turn his life around. 4 days after arriving in Boys Town in March of 1949, he ran away, stole a motor scooter, and then a car. He was arrested while robbing a grocery store in Peoria, Illinois, and was sent back to Indianapolis. Officials here, embarrassed and frustrated, sent him back to reform school in Plainfield. Unquote. So, first of all, can I just point out, not one but two different clergymen pointed out how, like, literally beautiful Charlie Manson was, which is super fucked up. You know, I know. Chances are, if you listen to Program to Chill, you might know something about Boys Town. But all I'm saying is that Charles Manson getting sexually abused as a kid is a seriously understudied aspect of Charles Manson's life. Manson doesn't stay very long at Boys Town because he explicitly acted up in serious ways. You know, I know what was going on at Boys Town. Also, might I bring up what happened to Walter Breen? He was sent to an orphanage, and then he was recruited to go stay at a monastery but didn't stay very long. This makes you think, right? Now, from this point on, Charles Manson would just be, like, in and out of different institutions. I would definitely say Charles Manson was dealt a bad hand from the jump, but Indiana specifically fucked him up. By the way, if this section of the episode interested you, go back and see what Chaos by Tom O'Neill and Dan Pippenbring wrote about this period of his life. Oh, what's that? Oh, not a lot, actually. Oh, interesting. Hey, don't worry, though. I'm sure that Tom O'Neill and his 20 years of writing this book, you know, he probably just, like, forgot. He probably just, like, forgot to look into Charles Manson's early years. It's cool. I mean, maybe Pippenbring would have looked into it, too. Oh, what's that? Oh, okay. I'm being told not to point these things out. Okay, moving on. By the way, I know some people say Terre Haute. I don't care. I'm saying it Terre Haute. What are you gonna do? I'm not from Indiana. So Terre Haute had another serial killer named Larry Eiler, also known as the Interstate Killer. He was a bodybuilder. He was well known in the Indianapolis gay leather scene. Eiler was basically the movie Cruising, except, as always, there are reasons to think that a lot more was going on. So, Eiler killed somewhere between 21 and 24 victims, all young males. Frequently, there was sexual assault involved. The police finally arrested and convicted Eiler, and he was placed on death row. In exchange for death row, he agreed to cooperate and name his accomplices. Eiler named Robert David Little, who was at that point the chairman of the Department of Library Science at Indiana State University. Little was also the former president of the Indiana Civil Liberties Union chapter. Now, Eiler had actually lived with Little, who also had a wife and kid there in the same home. Little had a kid. Had a wife and kid, I mean. Eiler would cruise for men, and he would bring men home to have threesomes with Little. Apparently, they would also sometimes make pornography. I don't know exactly what the wife was doing at this time, right? Sounds like a real horror show, however. Police arrested Little, but Little was ultimately acquitted, and he returned to his teaching position, even though he was super fucking guilty. But, interestingly, during Eiler's first trial, Little paid for Eiler's defense. Eiler had actually told police that Little had a private snuff film collection. Very strange stuff. Some people have alleged that Little was the mastermind. Not to go all Mari Terry, but some of the murders also took place around the equinoxes, solstices, and so forth. It would be really fun, not fun, but like, it would be interesting to get into the weeds on this story, but I think that there's more than enough there to point to something really weird going on at Indiana State University and so forth. Now, switching gears again, Alfred Kinsey is from Bloomington, Indiana. He founded his famous Institute for Sex Research at Indiana University, right there in Bloomington. Lord knows there's a lot going on with Kinsey. Shout out to my buddy Luke Marshall for doing a great episode on Kinsey on his show, Things Observed. Speaking of Bloomington, the Dalai Lama's brother, Thubten Norbu, moved to Bloomington, Indiana in 1965. He would join the faculty as a professor of Uralic and Altaic studies. Norbu also had a restaurant. His fail son, Jigme Norbu, would buy several motels, restaurants, and grocery stores. Most of them failed, but they set up the Tibetan Cultural Center, which is now known as the Tibetan Mongolian Buddhist Cultural Center. They do butter sculptures, which I am all for that. By no means am I an enemy of the Tibetan people, right? Just a certain priestly class. Now, the Norbu family still owns various properties around Indiana. The implication here that I should probably make explicit is that Tibetan expat groups are always affiliated with the agency, the CIA, especially Tibetan groups, and all the more so when it's the Dalai Lama's brother, right? Now, the Royal Order of Jesters is based in Indiana. I think the way I have things scheduled, my episodes with Monty on the Jesters will not have come out yet, but here's the short version. The Jesters are a secret society within the Shriners. They like to party, they like to get fucked up, they like to sleep with prostitutes, they like to sleep with underage prostitutes. Much more on that to come. In 1889, Standard Oil Indiana was started by John D. Rockefeller as part of the Standard Oil Trust system. It was based out of Whiting, Indiana, on the southern shore of Lake Michigan. They had the largest refinery in the Midwest. They sold the majority of all the gasoline and kerosene in the Midwest, like upwards of 90% of all the gasoline sold. That's wild. In 1911, they trust-busted Standard Oil, so Standard Oil of Indiana became independent. Then it was acquired by American Oil Company, which they called Amoco, which is amazing. Amoco, like in Spanish, that means like a booger. So anyway, there's a major chemical oil company based in Indiana which factors into all of this. Now, around the same time, Eli Lilly and Company was started in Indianapolis in 1876 by a Civil War veteran. He was a colonel for the Union, Eli Lilly. He was also a chemist. One of the first medicines that Lilly produced was quinine, which treats malaria. Or, to be clear, Lilly didn't invent it. That was just one of the first that he produced. And whether he realized it or not, and more likely he probably did realize it, that helped in imperial ambitions, right? I mean, the US invading a shit ton of banana republics is just around the corner here, right? They also developed the first commercially available insulin product in the U.S. By World War II, they had sales representatives in 35 countries and sold to the entire world. Eli Lilly exploded as the U.S. economy just rocketed after World War II, that post-war boom. But it's not through hard work and gumption, right? After World War II, the United States military seized Iggy Farben patents and research records. And as a result, Eli Lilly functionally stole just like a shit ton of research, including the rights and know-how to manufacture methadone. Interesting, right? Eli Lilly purchased it for $1. Eli Lilly also manufactured secobarbital, or Red Devils, as they were known. They say it was secobarbital which killed Jimi Hendrix. Wink. And it was a secobarbital overdose that killed Judy Garland, just like a ton of other celebrities too. They found tons of secobarbital at Jonestown, by the way. And doctors in Canada have been using it for euthanasia. That's been in the news recently. Now, even more interesting, Eli Lilly is the world's largest manufacturer and distributor of medications used in a broad range of psychiatric and mental health-related conditions, including clinical depression, generalized anxiety disorder, narcotic addiction, insomnia, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and others. Eli Lilly developed a vaccine preservative named thiomersal. You'll have to forgive me, I'm not a pharmacist. On a long enough timeline, I think people might eventually figure out what I am based on what I know how to pronounce, but thiomersal, aka mertiolate. I think that's how they say it in Spanish, so mertiolate, which is a mercury compound. They used it in vaccines from 1930 on. It also has just like a ton of other uses, like tattoo ink apparently uses it, or certain inks do anyway. Interestingly, and some people might know this, right, but like in 1999, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, asked for vaccine manufacturers to remove thiomersal from vaccines as a precautionary measure, and it was phased out in most US and European vaccines. Why? The CDC was worried that it might increase autism rates. I'm going to be honest with you, listeners. I'm pretty dumb, so I legitimately don't know about this, and I'm not going to take the show in a vaccine autism skeptical direction necessarily, but I do think it's incredibly suspicious that Republicans in 2002 inserted a provision into a domestic security bill which protects Eli Lilly from any and all federal court lawsuits claiming that thiomersal causes autism. Like, I don't know whether it does or doesn't, but I'm far more suspicious now that they did that. You know what I mean? Though, to be fair, autism rates do appear to have just continued to increase even after they stopped using it, so like, I don't know that that's actually the root cause or whatever. Listeners, I'm pretty dumb about science, I'll be real. So Eli Lilly manufactures Prozac, which I have not even begun to do any of the heavy lifting to figure out what's going on with Prozac. I know just enough to freak me out. Eli Lilly also makes Cialis, which, nice. The Lilly Endowment, out of Indianapolis and related to the Eli Lilly Company, was at one point the largest endowment in the world. I think the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation overtook them and then one or two others. But they started out with a gift of Eli Lilly and Company stock from the Lilly family. And they're still one of the largest endowments in the world. Their assets were measured at almost $10 billion as of 2014. And mind you, they founded this in like 1937, right? But what does the Lilly Endowment fund? Well, they heavily fund Indiana Christian churches, which I hope I have established tends to lean a certain way, politically speaking, I guess you could say. I mean, very far to the right is what I'm saying. Incidentally, Indiana is considered a Republican stronghold, and it has a tax atmosphere considered favorable to corporations. Wink.
Got a tow from a guy named Joe. Cost $60, hope I don't run out of dough. Told me about a sex offense, put him 3 days in jail. Stuck in Indianapolis, hope I live to tell the tale. Can't go west, can't go east. I'm stuck in Indianapolis with a fuel pump that's deceased. 10 days on the road, now I'm 4 hours from my hometown. It's this hell or Indianapolis with no way to get around. Called my girl, tell her of the trouble that I had. First time I called her in 10 days, guess that made her mad. Far as she's concerned, I can't stay in this Hoosier state. Stuck in Indianapolis with no way to set things straight. Can't go west, can't go east. I'm stuck in Indianapolis with a fuel pump that's dead. 10 days on the road, now I'm 4 hours from my hometown. It's this hell or Indianapolis, but no way to get around. Sitting in this bar is getting more than I could stand. If I could catch a ride, I really think I'd ditch this band. Who knows what this repair will cost? I'm scared to spend a dime. I'll puke if that jukebox plays John Cougar one more time. But if I ever leave here, I hope never to return. If I get that van back, oh, the road that I will burn. Right now my future's in the hands of the boys down at Firestone. Stuck in Indianapolis, feeling all alone. Can't go west, can't go east. I'm stuck in Indianapolis with a fuel pump that's deceased. 10 days on the road, now I'm 4 hours from my hometown. It's this hell or Indianapolis with no way to get around. Is this hell or Indianapolis with no way to get around?
Now, the Symbionese Liberation Army could have been called the Indiana Liberation Army for how many members came from Indiana. And we're not talking like ancillary or unimportant members, we're talking like the core cadre. I mean, let's be real, they were never that big in the first place. But except for General Field Marshal Sinque, aka Donald DeFries, who is from Ohio, which is not that far away, honestly. So I will go through several members of the SLA, and you tell me if anything stands out. When you're sitting there doing chores or commuting, and you shout, "Jimmy, what about this?" I can actually hear you, so feel free to interact in that way. So the SLA member General Teko, aka Bill Harris, of the fraternity Sigma Alpha Epsilon, as well as his wife Emily Harris of the sorority Chi Omega, were both originally from Indiana. Now, Bill Harris had fought in Vietnam as a Marine. Now, supposedly, Bill Harris experienced a 180-degree turn in his worldview after getting out of Vietnam and the military. Or, you know, maybe he didn't. So Bill Harris studied at the University of Indiana. Supposedly, he was a heavy LSD user. He worked at the Berkeley post office somewhat after that. And then he found the SLA through volunteering with black prisoners at Vacaville. Now, General Jelena, a.k.a. Angela Atwood, of the Kappa Kappa Gamma sorority, she met the Harrises, if you can believe it, at Indiana University, before they all ended up in the SLA. As an interesting side note, Angela Atwood worked in a restaurant bar in the same building as the Bank of America in San Francisco. Along the same lines, and focusing on Indiana, there is an interesting photo from the Indiana University archive. It shows Gary Atwood, who was Angela's husband who did not join the SLA. It shows him walking away from Angela Atwood, and there's this traffic sign between them which says, "Turn around." I don't know, maybe I'll make it the episode art. And it's just like, this is all before any of the SLA stuff. Just weird, right? But this photo ran in the Indiana University Alumni Magazine in 1970. The caption read, "Following directions, observing street signs pays off for Gary Atwood, junior from Newcastle, who, like the sign says, turns around for a passing glance at Angela DeAngelis, senior from Paterson, New Jersey." Now, Angela and Gary, their lives would take vastly different paths, because Angela would supposedly be shot to death in an SLA standoff, while Gary Atwood simply returned to Indiana. Interestingly, there's also this story about Angela Atwood, told by John McGinnis, former Indiana University student and friend of Angela Atwood. He said, "I only met Gary once. They had both just moved to San Francisco. I was editing commercials for Dianne Feinstein when she ran for mayor of the city. They found me in an editorial suite and we talked about their recent trip west. When they arrived, all their wedding presents were in their car. Then they made a bad mistake. They parked on the street and left all their presents in a locked car. The next morning, they found the car windows broken and every present stolen. Nothing was left. Angela was distraught, and I offered them to stay in my home while they could put their lives back in order. They declined and soon left. I did not know the Harrises. Emily was a member of Chi Omega sorority. Frankly, I was surprised that the FBI never contacted me about my Angel relationship. Angel acted as a production assistant on a film I was shooting for the Indiana Chief of Public Instruction. The film was a wake-up call for grade, middle, high school, and college-level students, basically an anti-drug production." To make that more clear, Angela Atwood, future SLA member, was interacting with the Indiana Chief of Public Instruction for an anti-drug film. Now, it is just like a straight, inordinate number of SLA members who were from Indiana. We're talking like a third of the core group. My contention is that they were agents provocateurs, much like the rest of the group, because it is exactly these types of games which were consistently being run out of Indiana around this same time. Let's run down the list briefly. CIA torturer Dan Mitrione started his career as a cop in Richmond, Indiana. Jim Jones, of course, was from Indiana. He started his earliest street preaching in Richmond, Indiana, where Mitrione was. Then, Jim Jones went to Bloomington and had his ministry there. William Branham helped Jim Jones start his ministry in Indiana, Bloomington, Indiana. Jim Jones would attend Indiana University also. If you'll recall, Angela Atwood was in a film for the Indiana Chief of Public Instruction Dan Mitrione's high-level cover was for the Office of Public Safety. My argument is not that Mitrione would have recruited Atwood, but that the same types of spooks use similar types of cover. And the hits don't stop either, because for some reason, when news of Jonestown hit, guess where the Guyanese ambassador to the U.S. was? That's right, he was in the good state of Indiana. For absolutely no other reason, I'm sure. Ostensibly, he was there visiting a friend. Listeners might recall that the serial killer Charles Ng caught fake documents showing he was born in Bloomington, Indiana, in order to join the U.S. Marines, right? Now, there is just a long list of spooks from Indiana. I will list off a few and know that this is definitely just a small sample. So, although Peter Lavenda was born in the Bronx and spent most of his time there, I think, at least in his early years, most of his family was from Indiana. Separately, G. Gordon Liddy was an FBI agent in the Indiana field office before he became a Watergate plumber. Richard Helms is not from Indiana, but he got his start as a reporter for United Press, where he actually got an interview with Adolf Hitler, by the way. Now, as to when Richard Helms joined and stopped being in the OSS is not clear, because he, after World War II, was the national advertising manager for the Indianapolis Times. I have a quote here which possibly gives some indication as to why Richard Helms had such a meteoric rise. Helms became a pillar of Indianapolis, joining the Athletic Club, the Woodstock Club, the Contemporary Club, the Traders Point Hunt Club, and the Literary Club. At the Literary Club, he gave a talk on his meeting Hitler. Helms became a regular at the Indianapolis 500 each year, and was considered one of the city's most handsome and eligible bachelors. Unquote. After this Indianapolis period, he was brought into the CIA, where he would eventually become director. There's Bert Servaas, that is a Dutch name as far as I can tell, who was in Delta Upsilon fraternity, a longtime Hoosier. He joined the OSS during World War II. He was in the China Theater, where his job was, and I quote, to disrupt Japanese river supply lines, train Chinese troops, and establish intelligence resources prepared for the invasion of the Japanese mainland, unquote. Servaas got the Taiwanese Medal of Honor from Chiang Kai-shek himself. So whatever he did, I'm sure it was probably fucked up. Then he worked for the CIA, and entirely unrelated, I'm sure, he went into business and was incredibly successful. He would acquire all kinds of businesses. He was also one of the architects of UNIGOV, Indianapolis's unique consolidated city government structure, which they created in 1970. There's a very interesting story there, which I am not doing justice to. Shout out Corn-Fed Communist for the tip. There was William King Harvey, sometimes called America's James Bond. Harvey had been both FBI and later CIA. Harvey's the guy who figured out that Kim Philby was a spy for the Soviets. He also did the famous tunnel in Berlin under, I think, the Soviet embassy to, like, eavesdrop on them. He was working with the Mafia to whack Castro in the ZR rifle project. He feuded with Angleton, famously. He worked on Operation Mongoose to do false flags to provoke a war with Cuba. Harvey died under suspicious circumstances. Anyway, Harvey was born in Ohio, but he went to Indiana University, and he would return to Indiana at the end of his career. I've already mentioned the Royal Order of the Jesters, but just as the Jesters are tied to Indiana, so too is the NSA. For those who don't know, Herbert Yardley of the Black Chamber, it was from Indiana. The colonel who set Yardley up was from Indiana University. The general who ran the early version of what eventually became the NSA was from Indiana. Louis William Tordella, the longest-serving director of the NSA, was from Indiana. There's a long list of correlation points linking the NSA and Indiana. Even the NSA building in Washington, D.C. uses Indiana limestone. Incidentally, not too far from Bloomington, Indiana, in Crane, Indiana, there's the Naval Surface Warfare Center Crane Division, which is one of the larger naval installations in the world. Initially, they started out as an ordnance testing facility. Now they do all sorts of interesting things, like they do a lot of naval infrastructure support, they do engineering work, they work on flight systems, weapon systems, simulations. My personal favorite, they do electronic warfare. Like, we're talking research into weaponizing and defending against military applications of electromagnetic energy. Real wavy shit. Somewhere near Terre Haute, in Newport, Indiana, there's the Newport Chemical Depot, where they manufacture, or used to manufacture, all kinds of explosives, heavy water, and they were the main production site for VX nerve gas. Now to switch gears and talk about MKUltra, MKUltra Indiana, as it were. One of the MKUltra sub-projects, entitled Subproject 112, was oriented around studying perception of occupational roles in children from 1st to 8th grade. By the way, it's not at all clear to me what this actually entails. According to one memorandum from March 24, 1960, the CIA's interest, quote, is connected with the current problems of vocational guidance with possible application to the selection of technical and scientific careers, unquote. So to me, that sounds like grooming children into technical and scientific careers for the CIA and, you know, just the national security state. Gifted kids, right? Interesting. So, among the many institutions that received MKUltra and MKSearch funding included the University of Indiana. Unrelated, I'm sure, Mark David Chapman's dad worked for the U.S. Air Force and moved their family to Indiana. Mark David Chapman would live in Indiana for a number of years. His dad worked for Amoco. His dad also went to school at Purdue. Now, to get to wrapping up here and entering the much more recent era, Jared Fogel, Subway Jared, he's from Indianapolis. He would be arrested for child pornography, right, Mr. Subway Man? That is certainly a spooky enough crime, but apparently lesser well known, he actually ran a minor porn ring out of his dorm at Indiana University. Like, we're talking, as far as we know, selling CDs with pornography on them for $1 a video. Then there's the Indianapolis FedEx shooting in 2021, which is a weird incident where a brony, who was maybe a white nationalist and or definitely a man-child, he went on a shooting spree at his former place of work. Now, obviously, it hardly indicts Indiana that there are mass shootings there, because there are mass shootings in every part of the country. They also found young Dolph's murderers near Terre Haute, but again, I don't know if that's the most damning thing, right? Maybe one of the last notes I would make is the weirdness around Indiana being so visibly part of the very popular TV show Parks and Recreation. Like, get this, okay? Most of the creators are not from Indiana. Of the two creators of the show, Greg Daniels was an East Coast WASP who went to Phillips Exeter Academy and then Harvard. And Michael Schur was raised in Connecticut and then went to Harvard. Like, these are not Hoosiers. Amy Poehler is from Massachusetts. So, like, I'm not saying, oh, you can only write what you know. And obviously there's no shortage of shitty scripts about New York City and California creative types. but I would argue that, like, there's something perverse about the show. Like, people give The West Wing a hard time, but in some ways Parks and Recreation has, like, a really bad case of liberal brain bullshit, just as bad as The West Wing. The show sort of enshrines the virtue of civics and local politics, but at the same time also, like, mocking any sort of populist or even just, like, normal people, you know? And, like, don't get me wrong, I'm not a killjoy. Like, I watched Parks and Rec. Like, I think it's funny to a certain extent. I'm just saying, like, the show kind of rubs me the wrong way. But, last section here to finish. Indiana is sus, but what does it mean to say a place is sus? I've thought about this a long time. I think that, like, to a certain extent, if you simply pay attention to a place, you start to notice things. I think that for sure there's a degree of observation bias going on, that simply noticing Indiana weirdness, like, causes you to find more and more weirdness. I do legitimately think that every state is like this. Maybe I'll do that project that Sufjan Stevens couldn't carry out and do an episode on every state. That said, obviously certain states are weirder than others, right? Like Texas, Florida, California, Washington, Virginia, New Mexico, maybe Connecticut are all, like, particularly up there. And, you know, to a certain extent, there's a correlation between just, like, where the majority of the population lives, where industry actually is, and, you know, what constitutes susness, right? A major element of something being sus, I would argue, is it not being what it seems or not being what it's known for. And, like, I would think that in the case of Indiana, I don't think it's particularly known for having a lot of drug trafficking like Texas, Florida, and California. It's not known for having a lot of military and intelligence ties like Virginia, Washington, and New Mexico. So, in some ways, Indiana is the outlier, simply because people don't perceive it that way. And I think that discrepancy adds to the susness factor. Then, given its historical role as stolen Indian land, its outsized history with subversive secret societies, its weirdly prominent role in the history of eugenics, the Klan, Christian identity churches, powerful extractive heavy industry, all the Freemason and jester fuckery, and the large number of intelligence ties, I think it is safe to say Indiana is one hell of a weird place, man. They're like the White Russians of America. They're like an insane contingent that always seems to push for things to get weirder and weirder. For sources today, I used the lovely book The Nazi Hydra in America, Suppressed History of a Century by Glenn Yeadon and John Hawkins. I used the book Revolution's End by Brad Schreiber. I used this book Knights of the Golden Circle, Secret Empire, Southern Secession, Civil War by David Keene. I used that book on the CIA doctors by Dr. Ross. I used a whole bunch of articles as well. Thank you for listening, dear listener. Just tell a friend about the show. I appreciate that you have been doing that. Thank you so much for listening. See you next episode, and God bless.
Indiana wants me, Lord, I can't. smiling face or touch your hand. If just once more I could see you at home and our little baby. Shame.